Blog Talk Radio.
Heather McCray, and you are listening to CPR Radio on the Authentic You Radio Network. So I'm pleased to announce that this will be our last show on Saturdays. Our new show will be starting a week from this coming Monday in April, and in alignment with my new coaching practice, which is Neurodiversity Coaching. The name of our show will be Neurodiversity Radio. And I can't think of a better segue into our guest today, who is the expert on neurodiversity, and that is Dr. Thomas Armstrong. And I'm so pleased that he's here to talk about this topic, which is really at the core of my focus and my professional work with adults and children. Dr. Armstrong, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on, Heather.
I have to tell you, a couple of months back, a friend of mine introduced me to the word neurodiversity, and I worked for 7.5 years as a classroom special educator, and it was as if this, I mean, it wasn't just a light bulb or an aha, it was like a huge lightning bolt, you know, bopped me on the head, because that word gave name to what my experience was as a special educator, which is that all of these children that everybody thinks are such little craps or whatever are actually the brightest, most gifted people I'd ever met. And when I looked up neurodiversity on the internet, you were the first person who came up as the expert.
Blog Talk Radio.
Happy Saturday, everyone. This is Heather McCray, and you are listening to CPR Radio on the Authentic You Radio Network. So I'm pleased to announce that this will be our last show on Saturdays. Our new show will be starting a week from this coming Monday in April, and in alignment with my new coaching practice, which is Neurodiversity Coaching. The name of our show will be Neurodiversity Radio. And I can't think of a better segue into our guest today, who is the expert on neurodiversity, and that is Dr. Thomas Armstrong. And I'm so pleased that he's here to talk about this topic, which is really at the core of my focus and my professional work with adults and children. Dr. Armstrong, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on, Heather.
I have to tell you, a couple of months back, a friend of mine introduced me to the word neurodiversity, and I worked for 7.5 years as a classroom special educator, and it was as if this, I mean, it wasn't just a light bulb or an aha, it was like a huge lightning bolt, you know, bopped me on the head, because that word gave name to what my experience was as a special educator, which is that all of these children that everybody thinks are such little craps or whatever are actually the brightest, most gifted people I'd ever met. And when I looked up neurodiversity on the internet, you were the first person who came up as the expert. And so, you know, I know we've been hitting and missing each other. But I'm so thrilled that you're here today to talk about this topic because it's so important to me. And I was wondering if you would mind initially explaining what the heck neurodiversity is.
Sure. Well, the idea of neurodiversity emerged about 10, 12 years ago. It actually came out of the autism community and was used as a way of many people with higher functioning autism or Asperger's basically were saying, you know, we don't want to be considered as disabled. We're simply different. And so this woman in Australia, Judy Singer, came up with this idea of diversity instead of disability. And like you, when I first heard of the term about 5 years ago, I was, like you, cruising on the Internet, and I found neurodiversity.com. And the first thing that I saw on the front web page was honoring different kinds of wiring, honoring different forms of wiring. And that hit me like a light bulb as well. It just made sense to me, and I began to realize that it made sense out of thinking about our kids using a diversity metaphor. Think about biodiversity, for example. We don't say that a calla lily has petal deficit disorder. We don't say that a, you know, a gigantic sunflower has hugeism. But we do this with our kids. You know, we say you've got attention deficit disorder, you've got autism. We label kids with these what tend to be pejorative kinds of labels, when in fact most of them have, you know, all kinds of gifts that aren't being recognized. And that's, you know, what drew me to the term. And when I started to research, I started to dig up all these positive things about people who have autism and people who have ADHD and people who have dyslexia and people who have mood disorders and people who have intellectual disabilities. And it just seemed like the not any attention was being given to the gifts. Everything was focusing on what was wrong, what was bad, what was difficult, what was challenging. And I'm not saying that there aren't challenging things that and difficult things that are related to each of these labels, but I'm suggesting that first we ought to start with the strengths when we are looking at an individual who has one of these labels. Because if they don't have a sense of themselves in terms of their strengths, they're not going to be able to make it through the challenges and the difficulties. And I think that, like you, I was a special education teacher for several years, and I had these kids in my classroom, and I knew, you know, intuitively that these kids had a lot of things going for them. I had great storytellers, I had great artists, I had people who were good with three-dimensional, like Legos and that kind of thing, kids with amazing personalities. And all of these things were sort of negated when they came into my class because they were defined as being learning disabled or behaviorally disordered or whatever. So, yes, like you, I really agree that this is a model that we can begin to think like we think about biodiversity, like we think about cultural diversity. You know, if somebody has a different color skin than you do, you don't say they have pigment deficit. You know, you say they, you know, we honor and we celebrate the differences that we have in cultural diversity. Same thing with biodiversity. You know, there are plants in the Amazon that could cure cancer. You know, there are all these resources. And the same thing in the special education population, that there are kids in the special education population who may have the secret to the answer to AIDS or cancer or something like that. And if we simply treat them as if they were disabled or disordered or dysfunctional, we're never going to find out what they really know and what they can really do.
I really it's funny because I feel like I have a teacher crush on you, just because you have articulated so beautifully what has been in my heart for years. And you know what you said you noticed about the children for me was right away. I mean, and a lot of the times what I noticed with the kids was that because their behavior, many of them, was so loud that it drowned out, not through any fault of their own, but it would drown out anybody's ability to see what else was there. And I just am so drawn to the idea of expanding, like you said, you know, and it sounds like you're doing that anyway, expanding neurodiversity to really recognize every single human as somebody with a different brain, with somebody who
and somebody
thinks
with
differently.
Value.
With, right. I mean, the word that you had on your website that I just really opened my heart was that you used the word pathology. And you said it's time to stop pathologizing everything and making everything about having, you know, being a disorder and being wrong, rather than just, you know, like I would even expand that to somebody who was born whose body requires a wheelchair.
You know, exactly.
Because you never know what that person's offering is. And I get so frustrated with people who immediately focus on pity and ego when they look at somebody whose body doesn't work the same way theirs does. Because to
exactly.
me, it closes your mind to what, you know, to what gifts that person they have to offer you, just because their body shape or image may be different than yours, or the language they speak may be different. And I love what
yes.
you said about, you know, about flowers, you know, you know, having a largeness disorder or something like that. I just thought that was brilliant. And I know you are such a busy man with your speaking and stuff. You have a book coming out, don't you?
Well, I've already written a book called The Power of Neurodiversity, which really looks at this from a kind of an overview, and it's written for basically anyone. But I'm also working on a book that I just turned into the editor yesterday, as a matter of fact, called, at least tentatively, it's called First Discover Their Strengths. And it's going to be applying the idea of neurodiversity to the classroom, to both the regular and special education classroom. And it's going to go out to a lot of educators around the country and hopefully around the world. And it'll show them how to create, basically I use this concept called positive niche construction. And,
right.
you know,
can you say
in
more
terms
about
of
that,
building
please?
Yes. A niche is something that animals use. They create their own niches in nature. You know, the bee builds his hive, the spider spins a web, the beaver builds a dam. What they're all doing is they're creating an environment within which they can flourish. And so I think this is a great metaphor to use when we're talking about kids with special education labels. What we need to do is be able to help them create environments within which they can bloom. And in this book, and I think I also get into this in The Power of Neurodiversity, building this niche consists of several kinds of ingredients. First of all, positive role models. I think these kids should know that there are people out there who have the same disability that they do, who have triumphed, who have been successful in life. You mentioned people in wheelchairs. Well, what about Stephen Hawking? What about Itzhak Perlman?
Yeah, no better example than Stephen Hawking right there.
Yeah, exactly. And Itzhak Perlman, I heard him play a Mendelssohn violin concerto last night on PBS, and it was absolutely wonderful. And, you know, in terms of dyslexia, Tom Cruise, we've got, you know, Hans Christian Andersen, you've got Agatha Christie for ADHD, you've got all kinds of people, most of the people in show business, actually. You know, an interesting thing for mental illness, it turns out that half of the presidents between the late 1700s and about 1940 or something like that had some kind of mental illness, half of the presidents. And so, you know, you can say, well, that was, you know, we really dodged that bullet. But in fact, these were individuals who overcame their disabilities to, you know, to do something really important for the world, for the country. So we shouldn't sell these individuals short. We ought to be communicating these heroes, these role models to our individuals, to our kids with labels, so that they can say to themselves, if these people can do it, so can I. So that's one of the ingredients. Another ingredient is positive career aspirations. We ought to be planting the seed with these individuals that there are things in life that they can really do, that they can be positive and make a positive impact on. For example, the ADHD person should not probably be in a job that's a 9-to-5 desk job in a large impersonal corporation, because they're going to go crazy in that environment. They should be in an environment.
I can attest to that, having survived working as a receptionist at a pharmaceutical company. It was a temp thing, you know, in between gigs, but it was, you're absolutely right about that. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, just that they need movement, they need novelty, they need high stimulation, they need an opportunity to do something new, something different, you know, so that they don't get bored, that kind of thing. So firefighter, itinerant teacher, emergency room physician, you know, all of these are kind of high energy sorts of moving along kind of occupations that would fit more with the ADHD person. So actually in the Power of Diversity, the book that I just had published, I list careers for each of these mental health disorder labels and talk about, you know, how a person can be successful in each of these rather than being unsuccessful in the career that they're not suited for. For example, a person with autism might make a great taxi driver because they would be able to have this ability. I didn't talk about autism, but autistic people have a real knack for understanding small details and for understanding systems. And those systems could be computer systems, computer programming. They could be mathematical systems. They could be a map of the city, so the taxi driver could do really well. But they would do really poorly in the role of a taxi dispatcher, because they would have all these interpersonal things happening one after another, and the input would just be too much for them. So being able to make some discriminations, Temple Grandin, who many people have heard of, who's an autistic individual who's an animal engineer, who's developed a third of the animal machinery designed in the United States and had an HBO special on her biography, has written a book or two on career, you know, paths for people with autism. And I think that her voice and other voices like that should be heard over the voices of psychiatry. You mentioned the fact that we have so much pathology in our culture. The DSM-4, which is the psychiatrist's Bible, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, when it first came out in like 1960, 61, it had 100 disorders, mental disorders. Now in the DSM-4, it has 300 disorders. So the number of disorders have tripled in the last 50 years. So, you know, and in fact, the DSM-5 is coming out in, I think it's coming out next year, and it's expected to have even more disabilities in it. So we've become, in the book Power of Diversity, I talk about how we've become a culture of disabilities, and we need to counter that by thinking more in terms of what are the positive attributes, what are the diversity dimensions of these individuals.
I couldn't agree more, and it's funny because when you were talking about the DSM-V and I couldn't help but think about the drug companies, you know, and you see some of the craziest commercials, like, if your leg wiggles too much, which is a common thing for folks like me with ADHD. And I actually found out in a workshop in an unrelated manner that I was talking to a psychologist about, and she said that that's simply my body's way of helping me to attend to something that requires my attention that I'm having a hard time paying attention to.
Exactly.
And now, you know, drug companies are coming out with drugs to help your legs not be wiggly at night and all this other stuff. And I just think, you know, I'll bet you a third of what's in the DSM-V was created by the drug companies or something, rather than it being something that really has to do with neurology.
Well, the drug companies certainly feed into this process, and I don't want to dump on drugs totally. I'm, after all, taking a couple of antidepressants. I have a mood disorder, and I take antidepressants, and they help me. Some kids need, are helped by Ritalin, et cetera. But having said that, I think that the pharmaceutical company issue is a big one, that in fact it has created diagnoses where there shouldn't be, where there are in fact differences, where there are alternatives. I actually wrote a book a while back called The Myth of the ADD Child, and I included 50 strategies that didn't involve drugs, labels, or coercion that parents could use, you know, before going into the whole issue of drugs and medications, so that they're available as a last resort. I didn't go into taking antidepressants right away because I wanted to see if other things worked, you know, psychotherapy, meditation, exercise, and it turns out I just needed that extra boost. So, you know, as a last resort or as, you know, something to put a foundation underneath someone, that can be a good thing. But we're going crazy with this, you know, with the drug companies, and their connections to doctors and their connections to the advertising. I mean, how many commercials do we watch now that involve, you know, mental health medications of one form or another? And it's almost like they're pitching them to us now, and we're supposed to go to our doctors and say to our doctors what we need, when in fact it's the doctors who should decide what we need. You know, and so the drug companies are playing on that. They're saying it's almost like commercials for that really sugary cereal to sell to kids, because they show them on these children programs in the mornings, and so the kids will go up to their parents and say, Daddy, Mommy, buy me this. So it's almost like this at an adult level. They'll say, gee, I saw this commercial saying that I could relieve my depression with this drug, so I'll go to my doctor. And so the doctor has just been visited by the pharmaceutical representative and was given free samples. So he says, well, maybe you need it, and he gives them some free samples, and there they are. They're on the way to a lifelong journey of drugs, and they may not need them. They may need them or they may not need them, but there's an awful lot of pressure in society, I think, for people to go on medications. And 50 years ago, I mean, what did people do? Well, they suffered where they probably wouldn't have suffered under medications, but in other cases, they probably avoided the side effects of medications. I mean, I've had all sorts of, side effects from the different medications that I've tried, and it's, in some ways been as difficult as the depression itself. But I agree with you. I think the pharmaceutical companies need to be reined in.
I like the way you just discussed the topic because we are completely on the same page. I actually was on Lexapro, and then now I'm having an ADHD moment, and then something else was and I remember when I was given a proper diagnosis of depression, I wanted to be the Lexapro poster child because for the first time in my life I understood what that was, and I felt like a new woman and just freed, and I, to this day, I bless every bit of medication I was on, including the medication I was on for ADHD, because if I hadn't had that to help me get kind of centered and grounded and, figure out what the heck I was doing, I couldn't have done the work I needed to do to get off of it. Now, and it's not about me saying that there's a cure, and that's not where I'm coming from at all. I'm just saying that I learned what I can do in place of those things to help me stay grounded and take care of me. And like you, I'm not against medication at all. For me, like you, it sounds like we're on the same page in this issue. It really depends on the individual. It depends on the circumstances. And, have you tried everything else first? What have you tried? And I also suggest for client families, for mom and dad to keep a journal when they're in the process of trying medication on with a child so that they can say, okay, I noticed today, this and this and this happened. Oh, this doesn't work. But to give it 3 to 6 weeks. Follow it like the letter of the law, and if it doesn't work or, everybody's unhappy, then go back to the doctor, take your journal with you and let them know what's happened.
Exactly,
but don't give
so
up
that
because
they can monitor the side effects. Yeah,
exactly,
very much. And if you think about it in terms of a diversity metaphor again, and think about humans as being flowers, well, different flowers have different needs. Some of them need a lot of sun, some need little sun, some need a lot of water, some need little water, some need extra plant food, that's manufactured, like our drugs are for us. And so, just like we are plants, we all have different requirements and different, ingredients that go into making us flourish. And for some people, that involves drugs, and for other people, it involves alternatives to drugs. And for some people, I think for even people who are taking drugs, they should be trying and doing other things as well to supplement it.
Yep, I completely agree with you. I agree with you because it's not... I mean, one of the hardest things for me, Dr. Armstrong, that I had to learn as an adult, and also being in the classic, in the classic autism realm, I have to watch white things, white sugar, white flour, no dairy or whatever. And I actually made the decision the other day based on years of kind of noticing myself. I've decided to go vegetarian at least for a while
to see
if that kind of helps. I'm sorry?
So did I. I actually just started being vegetarian about 8 weeks ago.
Really? How is that working for you?
Yeah, we seem to be on the same wavelength.
That's so
funny. What's
that? It's just funny to me because for me it was kind of, 50% about being more compassionate in terms of my, because, honestly for me it was number one, if I'm not willing to look at how my food is being processed and I have no business eating it if I feel guilty about it. And the other piece is I just know that I need more greens in my life. And if I stop relying on, heavy starches and beef, you know, then I'm much more likely to kind of gravitate towards the things my body needs, and it helps me listen more deeply.
Exactly. And that's another part of what I call positive niche construction, you know, looking at diet. For ADHD, the research suggests that these omega oils can be really helpful for attention deficit. For depression, a Mediterranean diet, a big study showed actually lowered the depression rate by 30% in a population. The Mediterranean diet is you know, olive oil and lots of fruits and vegetables and grains and legumes and just a little bit of poultry, fish a couple times a week, and very rarely red meat. And it seems to have a positive impact.
It's so funny that you said that, because I've thought for years that if I could use olive oil and garlic as a perfume, I'd be a happy girl. You know, because, I mean, seriously,
I agree.
The three of my favorite things in the world are olive oil, garlic, and basil.
You know, and I have a jar in my refrigerator of garlic olives. So the garlic with saturated, olives saturated with garlic, and I just eat them, you know, out of the can, just one after the other.
That's so funny.
Anyway,
are they black olives or green ones?
Well, I've got both. I've got the Kalamata, and I've got big green ones. Yeah.
You're such a grown-up.
So anyway.
I can't do the red olives. I just like the...
You're just talking a little bit more about positive niche construction for kids in special education. There are a lot of different environmental modifications that we can make. We know people for autism, for example, are often very sensitive to sensory input. And so for some people, loud noises can be excruciating. So giving them headphones or earplugs to wear when they're doing their studying, or even muffling the school bell, because the school bell can actually drive them crazy as well. So, you know, there are all sorts of environmental modifications that we can make. Human resources are another important ingredient for positive niche construction. In other words, creating a rich network of human beings who can support that individual in their journey. For a person with dyslexia, that might be a tutor that they have. For a person with ADHD, it might be a coach. For a person with a mood disorder, it might be a psychotherapist. But, you know, there are definitely a lot of different ways in which to structure the human network around an individual with a mental health label so that they can really get that support, get that encouragement. You know, have someone in your life who sees your strengths, who sees your positive aspects, who sees what you can become, you know, your ultimate potential. Because if you know, one of the things I found as a special ed teacher was that the whole field of special ed seemed to be permeated with the disability discourse. And so we talked about disabilities. We used tests to find out disabilities. We used remediation programs designed to remediate disabilities. And so it was all disabilities, all DDD words. And so there was, you know, there was nobody in that person's life, in that child's life, in that student's life, to believe in them, to see their gifts, to draw them out. And so that's, you know, really what I'm trying to do is inject more positive stuff into the field of special education and in general into our perceptions of people with disabilities, because, you know, we've got to change the paradigm.
I cannot agree more. And actually having team taught also, my wish list for the future of education would be for every teacher to have a master's degree in neurodiversity and, you know, have two teachers in the classroom, both of which have that background, you know, have a complete relabeling of special education, and that way... You know, all the kids are in the same, in a level playing field, because that way also the folks that, see, I don't know how your experience was, but for me, I would get so frustrated with either the parents of the kids who were in my classroom or the general education teachers who would teach them when I wasn't there, because there was so little expected of them.
Right.
And it frustrated me because I knew, like you do, that our kids are capable of so much more than they're allowed to do sometimes. And like you said, I mean, so much of their giftedness can have nothing to do with whether or not they can, you know, whether they can handle grade 9 math. I mean, I had a fellow that I taught who was put in a wrong, literally, I'm going to use the word wrong because it was wrong. He was put in the wrong special ed classroom for, at the time, what was considered really low-functioning kids. And this fellow was one of the most emotionally brilliant people I'd ever met. He could read people like a book, and he was so just brilliant. And it was so great because he was so his maturity level had been so stagnated that when he would start learning something new, he would start getting sleepy and fall asleep.
Yeah.
You know, because it was bigger than he could handle. But what was so great was that watching him have his personal ahas, like, oh, my God, I can do seventh grade math. Oh, my God, I can figure out how to do fractions. And you know, for me, that was, like, the most rewarding aspect of my teaching was having it affirmed again and again that the kids are brighter than they've been given credit for. And I think the fact that you are leading the charge in neurodiversity gives – you know, gives people like me and, you know, another other of us out there, you know, gives us hope and a reason to keep pushing and pushing and pushing for there to be a broader, more compassionate perspective on this field. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today, and I hope that you will come on the show again after your book is published and we can talk some more about this field, because I really appreciate your perspective. And I've learned so much as a result of your work, and I thank you so much.
Thank you. I'd love to be on. Thank you very much for having me on, Heather.
Thank you so much, Dr. Armstrong. Thank you. I want to thank again my guest, Dr. Thomas Armstrong, who is the expert in the field of neurodiversity. His website is www.thomasarmstrong.com, www.thomasarmstrong.com. He has several amazing books that are out. His website is a rich, rich resource. I thank Dr. Armstrong. If you are interested in getting a hold of me, you can find me at www.processdifferently.com. I am literally the only standalone neurodiversity coach there is, and I look forward to leading the charge as a coach and encouraging other educators, special and not special and general educators, to help expand this field. Have a great day and a great weekend. Love and light to you.